CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. No boundaries. Feel alive.
Hey, you. Come over here and listen.
Oh, God, I'm so fucking wet. Yeah. Yeah.
It's time for Audio Smut.
This conversation was recorded on colonized Indigenous land, which has long served as a site of meeting and exchange amongst many First Nations, including the Gagnegahage, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, Huron-Wendat, Abenaki, and Anishinaabe. The Gagnegahage people are recognized as the custodians of the lands and waters which nourish and sustain those of us who live on this territory known as Jajage. If you have the means to donate, please offer to support Raven Trust. You can find them at raventrust.com. A registered charity that raises legal defense funds to assist Indigenous peoples who enforce their rights and title to protect their traditional territories. As white-bodied settlers who non-consensually occupy colonized Indigenous territory, I want to call out the complexities in sharing this discussion centered on self-pleasure and mindful embodiment as liberatory praxis. The separation of mind and soma is a tool of colonization and white supremacy. It's the cultures and understandings of bodies of color that most often are the originators and keepers of these wisdoms. We are sharing our awareness and personal experience with great gratitude and reverence for this knowledge.
Yeah, so my name is Ilana Bordelik. I'm a trans woman. I am a sex worker. I am a former professional. My academic background, which informs how I think about the world, is based in linguistics, specifically semantics. Psychology, math, and law. These are the things that I studied and have degrees in. Otherwise, I'm also polyamorous. I am bisexual, pansexual, whichever one you prefer. And I'm also a first-generation immigrant from Eastern Europe. I like to call myself an ecclesiast of the erotic and a priestess of the perverse. You know, I've covered a lot of ground in my sluthood throughout my years, and here we are talking about it too, right? Second. And I'm going to get you to introduce yourself.
Yeah, I go by Ro, Rose. Some of the social and political identities that I hold in my heart and body are Anglo, white, immigrant from Houghton, Oakland, an uninvited settler in Jajage, Montreal, crone in training, trans, gender fluid, F to X boy with an I, non-monogamous, queer leather dyke, and rheostat. And rheostat's the word I use to prompt conversations because boxes give me the heebie-jeebies.
Yeah, right? Like, I mean, identity terms are really good and they're helpful, but sometimes once you start diving into them, you're like, they don't quite fit. There's something that chafes here. I need a better word. Right? And your word is rheostat and mine is demiurge. So tell me more about the rheostat.
I came to the term rheostat while I was studying queer theory. And at that time, Q was just being added to the LGBT alphabet. And I was enraged about that because I thought of it as the antithesis of boxes. And at the same time, I hold a lot of love and adoration for that Q and that alphabet. It means the world to me. And it still enrages me. I have a lot of complexity around that. So I went looking for another word, like two Canadians that I met at a kink event that said they identified as rheostats. And I was like, it prompted a conversation. And that's what I loved about it.
Your dialogue is so much like, you know, conveying your identity through dialogue is so much easier and better, ultimately, and more subtle, right, than doing it with a single label or even a series of labels.
Yeah, right? I think the narration allows for the humanization.
Yes, that's well said. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so a rheostat is a light dimmer. So a light dimmer encompasses an entire spectrum. And I've always felt that I have all of the universe within me in regards to gendering. Mm-hmm. I struggle with the term non-binary because I love being a woman and I love embodying masculinity. And I most often try to hold all of those things all at once rather than... rather than pushing them away mm-hmm. and being something totally different. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that in and of itself is a circle that a non-binary and the encompassment of everything often collide into their own similar ways of being.
So. Right. Like, so you know, in a way you're saying, like, I am the spectrum. I don't fall in the spectrum. I am the spectrum.
Boom. Boom. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
Yeah. My term, the one I like to relate to, is demiurge. And that came up for me because I didn't quite like the prefix trans in a lot of trans, especially in the word transition, because I didn't feel like when I was transitioning that that's what was happening for me. I felt like, from my perspective, I was rehabilitating. I was healing some part of me. I wasn't becoming something that I was not, right? In sort of like a really strict dictionary definition, trans something implies that there is one category that is essential in a way that is changing into some other category that is essential in a way. You know, we talk about transitions of power, right? Mm-hmm. A different administration comes in, right? I am not becoming a different person in a way. I'm becoming what I've always needed to be. I just needed to do some healing to get there, right? And so, like, I prefer to use gender rehabilitation, and I prefer to use the word demiurge to describe myself, because that's a term I borrowed from a spiritual concept where the demiurge is this sort of like force demigod thing that executes on the design of the divine, right? So the divine designs, says there shall be a sky and there shall be an earth, and the demiurge comes in and fashions this actual sky and the actual earth out of chaos, right? It's the executive function of the divine versus the design function of the divine. Mm-hmm. And that reflects a lot about how I feel what transition or gender rehabilitation is like to me. You know, it's the process of coming to the chaos of not even having the words to describe myself, all the way through to the process of becoming myself, you know? And that seemed like, you know, that really resonated when I read that definition of what a demiurge was, right, and discovered that. I was like, that is it.
But I love that yours really centers your own authority.
True.
Like,
yes.
You are the divine, and you are alchemizing into what you need to be.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, exactly. I'm actually kind of mythologizing my own agency in order to find it. You know, like, that's kind of the piece here is like, I like the spiritual mythological aspect to this, you know? Yeah. We are gonna, I think, talk about pleasure, self-pleasure, right?
Yes, self-pleasure. Mm. Yeah. One of my favorite things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We do want to spend a little bit of time on the why, even though we want to spend most of the time on the practical, because we did a little bit of research and asked around, and we were told that most people wanted to know, especially in the trans context, give us a how-to.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, give us the practical, like, and let it not be take a fucking bubble bath, right?
Yeah,
not taking that route. Yeah.
Yeah. No, we're going to try to be a little bit more specific, but we are going to spend a little bit of time of why on talking about the abstract, because we do feel that you can't really talk about the praxis, the how, and the what of it without having a bit of understanding, right?
Yeah, I mean, politics inform our movements in the world, so we do want to acknowledge that for sure. Yeah, hopefully we can offer some options to walk away as starting points for your own pleasure explorations.
We're going to try to talk about curiosity over outcome and process mm-hmm. over goals, because you know, it's going to be very hard for us to tell anybody where anybody particular individual pleasure lies, but we certainly, I think, we can share some ideas about how to explore pleasure, to come to it, to find your own pleasure.
That we wanted to spend a little bit of time also thinking just abstractly, right, about the why of joy and exploration. Why would we want to pursue that, right? And I think we both had the same reaction that in our experiences, it sort of started with a piece that we called embodiment, right, like feeling in your body.
Yeah, being able to feel...
yeah, anything.
being able to feel anything, certainly anything that felt like aliveness or pleasurable, because I had a lot of feelings in my body that I just couldn't tune into, refused to tune into, and turned away from. And for me, my kind of first access point into sensation feelings was through pain. It was my depression when I was a teenager, and I came out and I lost everything in my world, and suddenly I felt so much, and I think I hadn't felt much of a damn thing since my mother's death when I was a child. And the pain I had from depression led me into pursuing painful sex. Mm-hmm. And I was able to access a sense of pleasure while in pain. And so I associated the two, mm-hmm. but it gave me an access point that allowed me to pursue other forms of sensation play with time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think I had a very similar experience. I think certainly being in the closet, it's, you know, the pain of dysphoria makes you feel disembodied, right? To be fully present in your body is to feel too much negative stuff, right? And so you exist in this sort of dissociated state, right? And coming to self-pleasure, you know, because there's no other partner, you can't focus touching, so you can't give somebody pleasure as a form of pleasure, you can't be doing any of that stuff, right? You have to be embodied to feel your own pleasure. You have to be in the moment with yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, that was the, you know, coming to self-pleasure was also part of my transition or my gender rehabilitation, right? The process of saying, no, I need to be present here, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, certainly, like, before that, because I was sort of like, you know, that pain of dysphoria numbs you to your sense of self, that means that the only access I had to arousal was through either masochistic or sadistic pain, either inflicting or receiving pain. Mm-hmm. Because the only pleasure and the only excitement I could really access is through essentially adrenaline. It's a kind of pleasure, right? But it's sort of the only pleasure I kind of knew. I didn't really come to any other form of pleasure until I was able to come out and start being able to be more embodied in my sense of self, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that, like, you know, it's interesting that, like, your very different trans experience and my trans experience still meet here. Yeah. And overlap quite well.
Yeah, the first self-play I was really doing, and I mean first self-play, like, I was not masturbating, I was not fiddling with myself, I had no idea what was going on. My first self-play that I really allowed myself to sink into was needle play. Mm. And I mean, I remember I was in fashion design school and I was going to class with buttons sewn all over my arms, just all sorts of shit. And I was having so much fun.
Yeah.
And it gave me a sense of control. I think a lot of people who do so-called self-harm, mm-hmm. you know, can relate to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I didn't see or feel it that way at the time. Thankfully, I had a therapist who really understood harm reduction and met me where I was and was like, oh, let's talk about these buttons on your arm. What are you doing here, you know? And he really helped me focus on the positive sensations, the aliveness, the, like, nurturing piece that I was giving myself mm-hmm. to feel into the pain and move past the pain in order to understand the pleasure mm-hmm. that I was receiving from taking that time with myself and giving, giving myself the time to pay attention to my body and being in it.
Yeah.
I just hadn't done that before.
But still sticking with the why, you know, that embodiment piece that we were talking about, like coming to yourself, discovering pleasure, not feeling constrained to be in a place of adrenaline and pain necessarily mm-hmm. to be able to do that, you know, ultimately what that leads to is this notion of liberation, right? Like that's, mm-hmm. these two things become intertwined, especially if you've spent some time in that state of dysphoria, right?
Yeah, so much of it can be wrapped up in shame that's been put upon us. And I found that embracing non-normativity of kink and pain play helped me dismantle a lot of the shame. Yeah, and I quickly moved into bondage and rope and started with pain play, doing painful rope on myself. And then that ended up into like sort of a meditative rope, which was a whole different way to access myself.
I masturbated, but I'm not sure that really counted as fully self-pleasure, right? It was kind of mechanical, you know, kind of almost like, I don't know, hygiene maintenance or something, you know,
yeah.
Or a release of a certain type of tension. It felt medical almost. But coming to real, true self-pleasure, it didn't happen until I was able to actually be more present in my body, right? And the more present I was able to be, the greater the range of sort of self-pleasure. And there's also pleasure and agency, like you were saying, mm-hmm. that I get to discover, which is beautiful, wonderful, and healing.
Yeah, I feel like understanding of queer theory and fucking with my gender and the pain of my coming out really helped me build the capacity to be disobediently engaged with not just the world around me, but with myself mm-hmm. and like gave me agency to say, oh, I get to choose here. I get to choose to do this differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I can find my way. I can trust myself, maybe.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It was a lot of like, maybe.
Yeah.
Find my way into that.
Yeah.
And even now as I'm, you know, just gendering in all sorts of fucking ways, it's like I have moments where that choice and what's happening in my body are incongruent. And I have to stop and be like, okay, what am I doing and what do I want? And are those things aligned, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's the safest possible place for you to experiment with your own agency and your own boundaries and stuff like that, right? Because as you said, you know, it's just you, right?
Yeah.
And then you also talk about, you brought up defiance, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the place also, and we were mentioning, like, you know, the part of the disembodiment comes from the shame that defines our identities as queer people.
I think that the building of capacity to better feel myself and take in that communication, just as I do my cognitive thoughts and my feelings, like allowing those things to be weighed equally in my considerations of what I'm doing and what I want, has helped me build capacity in ways that allow me to better show up in support of queer trans liberation,
mm-hmm.
And do that work out in the world.
Yeah.
You know, for me, gendering is very much a political action,
yeah.
And that starts with me doing it, you know, internally.
Yeah.
And it's been exciting to see that actually the more work I do with me, the more work I'm able to actually do in the world,
mm-hmm.
which is ultimately what I want to be doing. I want to be showing up. I want to be having hard conversations. I want to be engaging with people who have no fucking clue what the fuck I am, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And the more I'm centered on like what I'm doing and what I want for me,
mm-hmm.
the more I'm able to do that.
And like, you know, I think that there is a way in which like we're starting, like, so we've been talking about this abstract why, but we're starting, as we talk in more detail of it, we're getting into the how, because we're starting beating around the bush of the idea of setting intentions, right? The idea that thinking about what you want, what you don't want, right?
Mm-hmm.
That starts before the moment when you start actually engaging whatever self-pleasure mm-hmm. you're going to do, right?
So we've talked about the why, self-pleasure, and we're moving into intentions, which moves us into sort of the what we want. And I know that for me, so often when I'm considering what I want, I get a bazillion different voices coming in my head that immediately bombard me with these barriers, whether they're managing distractions, like, oh, I don't want to deal with getting the bed all wet. I don't have time to also take a shower.
Real.
Fuck it, never mind.
That's real.
saying. Play blanket changed my life. But more so, I think, is the barriers of the stories and narratives that we've been handed socially, where, you know, oh, I'm curious about this thing in my body, and I hear this voice in my head, or get a sensation in my body that gives me a no. And so I'll kind of start to like reshape my intention based on these narrations that aren't even mine, you know, these values and ideas of what I should be, all the shoulds
mm-hmm.
that we
mm-hmm.
give ourselves and are handed. And so I think when we, in order to talk about intentions, we need to acknowledge like the narrations that play into the shaping of those intentions. And what I would hope that people might take away from that is, as you're setting intentions, bring a lot of mindfulness to why you are setting your intention, in what ways, what influences in your body and in your mind and heart are shaping your intention. Because a lot of those pieces might not actually be yours. And that's where I feel like the understanding of queerness, of doing things in our own ways, of doing things differently, can help us suss those pieces out and be like, that's actually not mine. I don't have to hold it. I don't have to allow that in here.
Yeah.
Like I, in my brain, I literally turn to it and I'm like, fuck off.
Yeah,
and sometimes I say it out loud.
Yeah. No, I mean, shame is the conclusion, is the punchline to a storyline.
Mm-hmm.
It's the end of a narrative, right? Like, you should be ashamed because, and here comes a narrative, right? you shouldn't do that because here comes a narrative, right? And so, like, when those comes up, right, and you become self-aware of these narratives, you can be like, is this really my narrative? Is this my story? Or is it somebody else's story? But then, you know, when we're talking specifically about setting intentions, right, we wanted to talk about creating a container, mm-hmm. right? Making sure that you can sort of be encapsulated to really be alone, right? It's not really solo pleasure unless you actually are alone. Actually, come to think of it now, that's kind of the thing about the narratives, right? Is you get rid of all those stories. To be really alone, you got to be alone in your head and in physically in your body, right? You got to get other people's voices outside out of your head. Mm-hmm. The creating a container piece is actually something that I found kind of important for me as I'm exploring self-pleasure. You know, because for me, a lot of, in a practical way, calming the voices in my head, those stories that aren't my own, that are getting in the way, involves remembering that a lot of those external stories have to do with my, like, it's a thing that matters in relationship to other people, right? Like, if I'm in a room with somebody else who's telling themselves a story about who I am, then I have to, like, that affects me, right? But the reality of it is that when I'm alone, none of these stories matter. There's nobody there to see or judge or do any of the stuff unless I specifically volunteer what I did or didn't do behind closed doors, mm-hmm. right? It is, in fact, a safe place. I can actually do something that I may initially feel shameful. I can challenge my own sense of shame by going there, right? Because I know there's actually nobody to shame me.
Yes, yes, right? I can challenge my own shame.
Right. The only person who's shaming me in this moment is me. And that I can, that is the agency, liberation, embodiment part. Right? That part I can find a way to control. That's me. I can change that, right? Even if I don't know how right now, I know I can get there because it's me. It's coming from me. There's nobody else, right?
And that starts with just noticing that you're doing it. Like, you don't have to change it immediately. I think that's a concrete action step is, like, let me just notice when those shame voices show up. Let me not even exhaust myself trying to fight them yet. Let me just map it out. Like, yeah, where is it likely to show up? Because then I can be more prepared.
When you're mired in shame, right, there's a sense that there's a way in which it's very hard to access a sense of self, right? And there's this really weird thing where, like, the embodied liberation first starts with, like, you become a self, right? You get rid of shame so you can become a self. And then as you explore more pleasure, you kind of end up transcending yourself. Mm. Right? But you can't really do any of the transcendental self-pleasure stuff until you've actually become a self first. You have to first liberate yourself from the shame and then become a self and then transcend, right? Which is a fun process. And I know it sounds a little abstract, but I think that this sort of, like, I can't imagine how you do not feel a little bit transcendental when you've liberated yourself from a bunch of shame and you find that freedom, right? That feels transcendental. I mean, even earlier, I think when you were talking about your concept around the word trance, right? You sort of normalize it for yourself as referring to transcendentalism of some kind, right? Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I know that the practice of noticing when I'm shaming myself was a challenge to start with. I wasn't seeing it, but I was feeling it. And it took me a while to sit with the feelings and figure out what the actual verbiage in my head was. I could explain the feeling or sensation in my body, like, oh, this doesn't feel good. But then I wasn't sure why. And taking the time, often after I played, to journal, for me, that form of witnessing was really helpful. And I talk to everybody about whatever is going on in my mm-hmm. personal sex life. So talking with people I trust to say, like, I'm having this feeling when I'm doing this thing and I'm not quite sure where it's coming from. And between journaling and loved ones, I was able to often get to a place where I was like, oh, fuck me, this is shame from this thing or that thing, or so often my fucking father, you know? But it took the practice of just paying attention to where I was feeling discomfort, and then the practice of sitting with that discomfort in order to figure out what it actually was. Mm-hmm. And that is, maybe it sounds theoretical, but to me it was actually very practical. Like, let me first notice, let me then pay attention, mm-hmm. and then let me explore it. And I built capacity to do those things by doing them step by step consistently.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, like, intentions are all about where you direct your attention, right? And so, like, so that's going to become that's both a theoretical and a practical piece, because on the one hand, understanding that is a bit of a, you know, sit down and think about it piece, right? And then actually doing it is has a very concrete result, right? It's interesting that you say that you, like, you journal and you talk to people, right? Because for me, it's actually quite the opposite. The thing that I'm doing behind closed doors, where I'm kind of confronting my shame, when I'm going that deep in that sort of personal work with the intention of eventually finding a healing place, right? Part of being alone for me is the fact that I don't record it. There's no trace of it, right? That sense of, like, I'm alone here and it doesn't matter. Nobody's here to shame me. Means that I don't write about it. I don't talk until I've worked through it. I don't talk about it. The kind of self-pleasure where I've worked through something and it's now in the past and now I've digested it, I can talk retrospectively about what I used to do to people, you know, about, right? But, like, the thing that I'm currently exploring is an intensely private thing, you know, like, none of my partners, nobody else is invited in the space. I don't really talk about what's there. The best I get is very vague allusions to a general sort of area, right? But that privacy is important for my process of healing here. So it's interesting to see this the kind of diametric opposite. You know?
I love that difference. Yeah, because I feel like people could relate to those, and I would love to hear how people might relate differently as well.
Exactly.
For setting intentions, we've got a couple of questions we thought would be helpful for people to consider. I know that they've made a big difference for me. So I have a process that I usually go through. Before I do intentional self-play, I usually write my intentions. I have kind of my own, like, solo play journal.
Yeah.
And the first question I like to start with is, what do I want? And specifically, what do I want to feel? And often for me, that isn't actually in my body.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what do I want? What feelings, not necessarily physical sensations, do I want to come out with?
One of my coping mechanisms has for a long time been trying to be in control, right? And so this is a place where I do actually the opposite. It's the place where, to liberate myself from shame, I could kind of do the exact opposite.
Love it.
That's the place where I seek out the loss of control.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so, like, in doing that, it's a way for me to allow myself to abandon myself to a place where I would normally be resistant, because, let's say, I have shame about something, right? And then in finding that self-pleasure, I can, like, explore that idea, right? But it becomes a very sort of intuitive rather than explicit controlling process. And I don't mean that in any judgmental kind of way.
No, in case it comes across that way.
But yeah, because sometimes people use control as, like, a pejorative, right? But that, I'm just using it descriptively here. It's sort of like almost a semi-meditative space, you know, where, like, I just kind of let things take their course and see where things go, you know? That's sort of the intention of, what do I want to feel? Yeah. Well, I mean, I want to feel that liberation. Is usually the, like, overarching goal is, for me, is always, like, I want to be able to let go of something that I normally, when I walk around every day, somewhere in the back of my mind, I'm holding on to, you know?
Yeah, usually I want to feel some sense of relief, whether it's just energetically, or that I discovered something, or that I was able to pinpoint where some shame was, you know? Maybe I don't have relief from it, but I have relief knowing that it's there, and then I know that I can work on it.
Yeah, you gotta name it to tame it.
Yeah, that's right.
I think our second question was, what am I doing about it? So, what are you doing about it, bro?
I am very often setting an intention that I want to feel more ease in my body.
Mm.
It's often that generalized.
Right, right. More embodiment.
Yeah, and I deal with some chronic pain. And so, what I'm doing about it often has to do with, how can I position myself in a way to move away from the pain and move towards pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
So if my right hip has all my fucking attention because it's screaming at me, then I will consider, okay, what can I do with my left hip? Because I can give my right hip a break and I can explore my left side more.
Right.
And I happen to know that because I have more chronic pain on my right side feels more. So like when I'm masturbating and playing, I often go to the right side mm-hmm. because I feel more there.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to shift that in my body, so I will purposefully explore the areas where I know I have less sensation.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to sort of even things out.
Yeah.
Which benefits my chronic pain issue.
Yeah, so I think that is it. That's an example of, like, what do you do about it, right? That's how you get that next step, right? Like, well, what do I do about it? Well, I explore the side that isn't getting explored, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Which I think sort of indirectly brings up this theme that we'll probably sprinkle out throughout this how-to, is this idea of curiosity, right? It's usually a good idea to be curious about the things you don't do very often. You know, you want to notice the empty spaces and be curious about those, right? It's like, I don't usually touch myself there. Why is that?
Right? Exactly.
Do I not like it, or did I just not discover that it's pleasurable yet, or how it can be pleasurable, you know? So what do I do about it? Usually that step for me is sort of like deciding more generally, or sort of like at a medium level, what kind of play am I going to do, right? Like mm-hmm. the sort of decisions of like, am I going to bother to go through overcoming all the barriers to doing to using toys, you know, like penetrative toys, because maybe I need to douche, or maybe I'm going to have to take a shower after I have to pull out the lube, you know, set down a blanket, like, do I care to do this or not, right? Like that kind of thing. Like, you know, which part of my body am I going to be playing with, right? That kind of... That's sort of where I get to.
Definitely.
And oftentimes for me, that's something that actually comes, you know, that's also part of something that comes sort of well before, because a lot of times some part of my body is calling attention to itself. You know, like I'm feeling horny, right? Or I'm feeling some kind of tension or desire to and then it's coming from somewhere. It's calling me, you know, like I need to feel softness, or I need to feel release, or I need to feel something like that, right? And that's what prompts me to want to start planning a self-pleasure moment, right? Right? That's the what to do piece, right?
I love that you're using curiosity just like, oh, I want to explore myself. What is asking for attention?
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
A great question.
Yeah.
What's asking for attention? And our third question, what do I want to change or stay the same by doing this? So 3 years ago, I had a double mastectomy. It wasn't actually for gender reasons necessarily. That was a perk. Like, yeah. The ice cream was made up of like my back pain.
Yeah.
And just sort of wanting to be done with them.
Yeah.
I made a lot of money in sex work using my breasts. That was great and fun, and I knew I would be done with them eventually, and I got to that point. So for the first year, a lot of what do I want to change or stay the same in my solo play was, I want to encourage feeling mm-hmm. in my chest, and not necessarily like the capillaries growing back, but mm-hmm. more like, I haven't explored this piece of my body because it's been for the male gaze. Mm-hmm. It's been for money. It's been for my livelihood. It's been fun.
But you always knew you wanted to get rid of them, so they were never really fully yours.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. Is that fair to say?
Well, I've got these.
They're on loan. They're not here to stay.
Yeah. I expected to be surprised by how much I liked my chest, and I was. But what I wanted to change was sort of the gender remapping of this chest area. And I didn't know if that was going to take a masculine form, because I love my femininity. So mm-hmm. I wasn't taking them away because I didn't want to be feminine.
Mm-hmm.
But I really loved being able to remap the way that I related to my chest. And understanding that, oh, I actually feel my chest to be extremely effeminate for me.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, kind of more now, because other people are not interested in it in the same way. And so I'm getting so much more pleasure from it because it feels more mine.
Right. So that's going back to that thing I was talking about that kind of pleasure being found in aloneness, right? Mm-hmm. Like in a way... you're now alone with your chest. You know, if I'm trying to think to distill the shift in narrative around my chest after I had my breast implants, right? it's coming to understanding for me that the narrative around male chests is that it's a source of power, and that for women it is a source of vulnerability.
You know, when I was, take a quick segue, when I was thinking about having top surgery, I called everybody I knew who'd had top surgery to ask them about their experiences. And I had a friend who I knew had struggled with their surgery, and I called them up and we chatted, and they were telling me how awful they felt about having a double mastectomy when they're in bed with men, and how unsure they felt when they were in bed with everyone else, you know. And they just kind of went on and on and on, and I was like, okay, but how do you feel when you're by yourself?
Yeah.
And without skipping a beat, they said, oh, I fucking love it.
Oh,
and it, and yeah. My cheeks are flushing right now. I can feel my heart rate going up because I was so shocked by the speed at which they were able to say that and such conviction in their voice. And I was like, oh, fuck me. Okay, let me make sure I'm not making this choice because of anybody else. Like, what do I want to feel in my body?
Well, yeah, that's actually sort of similar to the question I asked myself when I was deciding what surgeries I wanted to get. Right. The question I ended up asking myself was like, you know, if I ended up being on a desert island, would I still want these surgeries? Yeah, obviously.
Like, yeah, exactly.
I don't want to be on a desert island stuck in this thing. You know, kidding me? Fuck that.
No, thank you.
No, thank you. Yeah, right. So that was like, okay, well, that's pretty clear as an intention. But I mean, you know, when talking about changing, we're talking about things changing and staying the same, right? But like, but that's the thing, is that like, you know, when you relate, well, we have the experience of having new body parts, essentially, that sort of forced us to ask that question, and very directly, right? Like, what about my solo play do I want to stay the same or change as a result of the fact that my body has now changed, right? And but that, you know, we're talking about top surgery here at this moment, but it also applies to vaginoplasties and phalloplasties and all that stuff, right? And that, I think, like the crux of that question, I think, that you're asking yourself is like, how much growth versus comfort do I want to experience, right, in my solo play, right? Am I going to go to a place that I know already is pleasurable, and I'm going to explore the nuances of it, the depth of it, right? Or am I going to try to be curious about something I haven't experienced yet? And our last and fourth question that we sort of suggest people, you know, as a prompt for people to think about intentions, we have, what do I need if what I said to myself as an intention doesn't actually come to pass? If I don't get what I wanted to get, right? What if I'm disappointed?
Yeah, how am I going to take care of myself?
Yeah, how am I going to take care of myself when I've disappointed myself?
Yeah, exactly that.
Right.
I think it's important to have our self-care plan, mm-hmm. you know? That's really what this question is about. It's like,
oh, for sure.
Let me remind myself that this is just an exploration, and maybe there are different paths to try. Maybe this isn't the right moment. Who, you know, there's a number of reasons, but... like, do I have a self-care plan in place?
My answer to the question, what do I do if I don't get what I want, is that, I mean, I have a range of things that I could do. I use watching Star Trek on repetition as a form of self-regulation, and not just, I mean, which could work here, but I use it as self-regulation in a bunch of different places. It's just, you know, it's a narrative I've seen a million times, and I know exactly what's going to happen, and it feels comfortable, and it feels like a fairy tale. Mm. You talked about practice and getting better at it, right? Like, there's a way in which you, part of that curiosity and the process over outcome thing, is that self-pleasure is a skill, right? Both, you know, intellectually, emotionally, and physically, right? You have, that's partly why we, the notion of exploration of joy, right? That's a skill you have to practice. And the more you do it, the faster and better you get at it, right?
I didn't have access to orgasms for fucking ever, you know? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, it was too baffling because I had that narrative that I was supposed to innately know. And then every time I would try, I would be like, oh, I'm a failure.
I think that we may actually be ready to get into some very, very specific nitty-gritty discussion of toys and techniques and genitals and all that stuff.
Yeah, all the fun how stuff. So we've talked about the why, the what, we moved into intentions, and we're moving into the practical how. This is what overwhelmingly people ask for. Okay, but practically, like, what does that look like?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to follow the line of purposeful curiosity with our intentions, and starting with sensation play and knowing whether the sensations that we're sensing mm-hmm. are a yes, no, or a maybe for us.
Yeah, absolutely. 2 feet. You kind of work your way up there, mm-hmm. right? And you brought this idea of this thing called you called lab time, right? Which I realize I totally do. I just didn't have a word for it, and I love your label for it. Mm-hmm. You know, where you kind of like workshop a feeling or an intense scene before you get to do the whole thing.
Yeah, I like to do really crazy ass shit. So rather than jumping in and seeing a scene go wonky, and also just for everyone's safety, oftentimes I would have just like lab time. Oh, I want to do, let's say, fire play on genitals. Well, I haven't done that before. Let me not do it in the midst of a scene. Mm-hmm. So most of the time I was trying whatever it was out on myself. So, yeah, you know, yeah. I made some fireplace space for myself for some solo play. And it's like, what does it feel like when I light my pussy on fire? Mm-hmm. And then practicing that, you know, with my partner, and then being able to like, okay, we're going to do a scene where this is going to be an element of it.
Yeah.
In a public space, you know, so. Yeah, I'm specifically exploring this toy today.
Right.
Like, I have a new toy. I don't know how to work it. When I tried it, I was like, whoa, shit. Like, let me just figure this toy out and let me get creative. But it's very specific.
Right. Talking to yourself and being like, telling yourself yes, and scanning in your body as you're doing something to say yes, please, no, thank you to yourself. Right. Is a really nice way to focus on the process of this curious, purposeful curiosity. Right. And like that kind of thing, when you talk about lap time, you know, that's like, to me, that would be an example of lap time. Just like lie down and touch myself all over my body and sort of try to figure out what exactly is a yes, please, and a, what it gets to a no, thank you, and maybe some things are maybes, you know?
Noticing where you feel something you want to move towards, maybe you would label that a yes. Okay, put a pin in it. Mm-hmm. Great. That's a yes. And then noticing what in my body told me that that was a yes, mm-hmm. or what didn't I feel in my body that told me it was a yes. Maybe mm-hmm. my stomach didn't clench and drop out. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I knew it wasn't a no, so I'm going with yes or maybe.
Yeah.
But trying to map out what does yes, no, or maybe feel like in our body.
When I discovered that my nipples became more sensitive through transition, right? At first, it was just, the first thing was, oh, this is a yes, please. In a place that maybe I haven't had it felt a yes please before, right? And then, and in a completely different session of self play, there's like a, okay, well, let's start here and see how far it goes, right? Let's workshop this and see, like, okay, so soft, hard, fast, round, you know, like pain, yes, maybe, how much, you know, like that kind of thing. And that to me is a good example of like this process, and then coming back to it over and over again and discovering and embodying yourself, you know.
Beautiful. Absolutely that.
With that in mind, I think that, you know, in terms of like really practical sort of exploration, maybe you also turn people onto the idea of like very explicitly thinking about, you know, the smoothness and roughness of things and how hard or soft they are and how big and small and how hot or cold, right? What else am I missing?
Yeah, I think taking the moment to scan for textures. Like if I was going to describe the sensation with words, or if I was going to feel into the sensation in colors, or if I was going to imagine the sensation as an image, like, construct that for yourself.
Ro gave me my first glass toy, which allowed me to actually have a really lovely moment of solo exploration, where this was, you know, it was a toy that had two, it was narrow in the middle with two larger bulbs on either side, and in the center of it, the center shaft of it had a tiny bunch of tiny little dots for sort of a certain kind of roughness or texture, you know? And so that was really, you know, that was something that, like, not having had that kind of toy before, for example, because it was so hard and stiff, right? And it, because it was less wide than what I'm comfortably able to take, it meant that I was able to play with angles and find a whole bunch of spots that otherwise I wasn't able to find. And, you know, like I explored, you know, putting the whole thing in the fridge, and then got it warmed up. And, you know, I tried various parts of it on my clit and inside me, you know, like at some point I figured out that I could like take it sideways and use the little textured part in the middle to like rub up and down my clit, and it would also kind of stimulate the entrance to my vagina. You know, there's, you know, I don't know that I've even been able to make a whole inventory of all the new things I discovered, right? But that was an excellent sort of, I think, moment of self-pleasure that, like, you know, that allowed me to explore and discover whole new things and find a new place of embodiment.
Yeah, I get a lot of creative ideas from watching live cam feeds, and I do live cam feeds, which I really enjoy. Kind of sharing my explorations, my solo explorations with, you know, like strangers. But I enjoy watching them, and I really enjoy seeing the creativity that people come up with their bodies. They just find different ways, and it's like, oh, yeah. What are you doing there? I mean, even non-sexually, like, I love food play, generally. Yeah. So sometimes I'll get, like, you know, at the mache, they'll be like, this is going bad, like, you need to eat it today. Mm-hmm. I love getting that fruit, because usually it's still good enough to eat. It just needs to be eaten right now. And I'll go in the shower, and I'll sit down, and I just have myself a little fucking picnic.
Nice.
And I just make a mess, you know? And I imagine just, like kids, just the wild abandon of not having shame of eating clean, you know, and just like rubbing it all over my face and getting my face in there. And yeah, sometimes it turns sexual with myself, but often it's just the like sensation of the coldness of mango on my cheek, you know, or the like little seeds of a strawberry running down my forearm. Like those pieces are just so fun. Like
that's beautiful.
Sensation play does not have to start erotically. Like that solo pleasure is an entire fucking galaxy to explore.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I am thinking about the absence of sensation. And I mean, my brain's going immediately to like, I've spent time celibate. I've spent time stone. I've spent most of my time slutty. I've spent time monogamous. And just the different ways that I've, had engagement or non-engagement, the lack of sensation with partners, and then doing that with myself too.
Yeah.
Like there are times where like I just don't want to engage with my genitals.
Right.
Like I'm just not feeling it for whatever reason. And really kind of welcoming the other exploration. Moving from like sensation play specific to my genitals, or lack of sensation play specific to my genitals, and then lab time, which obviously, as I said, I've had increased lab time. Now that I'm taking testosterone, I have more access to sensations that I want to turn towards. And I've been kind of pleasure mapping my pussy as I'm kind of remapping what's going on there, because it's literally changing shape. But I'm thinking about like when I first started packing and I was using tube socks, and that was a form of kind of genital remapping for me, like oh, what does it feel like in my body to have this, and not even in a social situation, but just like at home walking around the house, like cleaning the kitchen, like
but that's the solo pleasure exploration piece of this, right?
Is, yes.
is the like lab, you know, lab timing packing at home.
Like what am I gonna do with this thing? Like how do I sit, how do I turn, how do I move, like how close can I get to somebody before they feel it, you know, like just all those kind of like testing it out. And then I remember like with a strap-on, like okay, well, what if I want to wear a strap-on under my skirt, you know? And I did a lot, you know, and I figured out how to, like, make a little tie so I could keep it down and, you know, quick release. And to me, that was, like, pleasure mapping my sense of genitals by playing with different toys and different sensations that they brought up in my body. Like, and then just being in dykedom and my absolute love and adoration for fisting. You know, like remapping my genitals to be my fist. Like my fist feels like my cock. That's for damn sure. Like there is no question about it. My energetic cock is all over my body in different places.
So I had to change the narratives around my genitals, right? Because even though physiologically they hadn't changed very much, right? I realized that if I created a narrative around it where I thought of it as a really large clitoris, it was easier for me to conceptualize and imagine how to touch it in pleasurable ways.
That's a gender remapping, the genital remapping too.
Right, so like And then I discovered that, for example, I didn't really even have to be erect to feel a great, like, to feel sensation and even have an orgasm, right? If I thought of it that way. Because if I thought of it continuously as a penis, right, then the reflex would be, well, it must be erect to get somewhere, mm-hmm. right? But I would, you know, this particular technique I learned online, and I don't know how many people hear about it, so I'm bringing it up here. For me, it didn't work particularly well, but I just want to share it, right? The idea is that if you follow the tubules that go up, they go up from your scrotum, right, into your body, the place where they go inside, right above sort of the base of the penis, right, or the clitoris, if you stick your fingers in there and sort of finger that canal, that can become really pleasurable and even orgasmic for trans women without bottom surgery. Yeah, and the other thing that, for me, what I discovered was some of the most pleasurable sort of self-pleasure was to basically use one of my hands on the shaft of my clit and to put it, like, to lie it down on my stomach, right? So I would sort of, like, lift it up until it was lying down on my stomach, which would bring the head of my, like, just leaving the head of my clit exposed. Yeah. And then I would be able, like, by pressing it against my stomach, I would stabilize it, and then I could sort of rub the top mm-hmm. of it, you know, like I would rub a clit and explore the various kinds, you know, circles, pleasure, whatever. And that I found very, very pleasurable, yeah. you know?
Since I've been on testosterone and my clit has grown, I've got this little tiny dick now, yeah. My little dicklet, and it's along with the increased sensation, it's shocking to me how similar that physical sensation feels of stroking my big clit as a cock, stroking it, and my energetic cock, when I feel like my forearm is being, well, when it is being sucked on by a pussy, I'm just like, yeah, that's actually the feeling. It's the same fucking feeling. And it's nice. So cool. And I'm so thankful that I actually, like, had that exploration to figure out, like, what does my energetic cock feel like when it's in pleasure? And then to now kind of have access to more understanding of that in my physicality is pretty mind-blowing and exciting, you know. I think, as you said a little while ago, the sexual versus the genital, mm-hmm. like my sex is an anatomy piece that is in transition because of what I'm doing to my body, but it doesn't change actually how I relate to my genitals. Mm-hmm. Like, I am not transitioning, but I'm putting my body through one hell of a thing right now.
Yeah,
you
exactly,
know?
Exactly.
And it's trippy to, like, see people relate to this body in ways that I don't feel I relate to it in. Mm-hmm. You know? And I'm like, what in the hell? Yeah. That's not my intention, but here we are.
Yeah.
And then trying to catch where I'm doing that in my solo pleasure. You know, like, I had moments of, like, coming back to discomfort, I felt maybe no as far as, like, stroking my clit off in the very beginning, especially mm-hmm. with a suction toy. I was just like, I remember, like, putting myself in it and being like, oh, fuck no, that's way too much. Like, there's no way in hell I can't. Mm-hmm. A, like, the power is just too much, and B, like, that is too overwhelming of a sensation. Mm-hmm. I'm not used to having sensation there. And then I used a sheet. And I put the toy over a sheet, and then I folded the sheet, you know, and I put it on the lowest setting. And then I realized, oh, I should actually get a cheaper toy that's less powerful, mm-hmm. you know, and I was able to find something that I was worked my way into.
And then there's a whole piece of, like, you know, after bottom surgery, right? Right. Because there's a very therapeutic piece to that where you're just massaging and touching. Even without necessarily eliciting pleasure, is good for, like, the, you know, like, as the nerves come back, stimulating them, it helps them grow. And there's a bunch of scar tissue, so, like, just massaging, you know, exploring various kinds of, like, you know, folding and holding and squeezing of the labia and this and the other thing and the base of the clitoris, it there's a pleasure in the massage of it, and the pleasure also of feeling of the, like, little sticky bits of scar tissue going away and a certain kind of sensation returning, you know? There's the sort of the line between dilation and masturbation, right? Like, mm-hmm. dilation is a very medical thing at first, but at some point it kind of, like, transitions to a place where you dilate by you can dilate by masturbating, right? And for me, I definitely got a lot of mileage out of quickly starting to use dilators, which were just toys, And actually even sometimes a little bit bigger toys than the biggest dilator that I could have. It was just sort of like lab time training, right? Like, I want to make sure that everything is stretched out and the scar tissue is gone. And so I'm going to go back to that piece where we're talking about pushing yourself versus like staying in the comfort zone, finding that place of just pushing a little just to make sure everything is settling in right, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Because I kind of knew early on that I was on my way to a bottom surgery, that's what I wanted. And, you know, so there was some time there to organize and time to wait on a waiting list and stuff like that, right? So, and in the meantime, I did spend a fair bit of time exploring my clit prior to vaginoplasty. Like, I knew because I had a limited time that I wanted to do a lot of exploration, get experience as many things I could experience in this space, because I knew I wasn't going to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so there was also this sort of like pleasure mapping, self-exploration, genital remapping thing that I did there for a period of time.
So if we want to distill down what we have for pleasure mapping, moving forward with the playful curiosity to explore sensations.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we're just starting with exactly where I'm at right now. What do I feel right now? Not what do I want to feel, but what do I feel right now?
Mm-hmm.
And using sensations, figuring out and listening to our bodies to see, okay, where do I have a clear yes?
Mm-hmm.
And can I make some lab time that explores that more specifically? And then what does it look like in that lab time when I'm in pleasure?
Yeah.
And then you can start pleasure mapping, like, oh, these things very concretely and specifically I know that I want to turn towards.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think we hope that we gave you some ideas as to where to go.
Yeah, and I want to keep having this conversation. Anybody else, let us know.
Yeah, that's right. Reach out, see where we can take this.
Mm. Hey, y'all. It's fucking hard being in these bodies, especially when their sensations have been attached to shame via oppressive expectations of gender. If you're curious about somatic gendering or erotic embodiment coaching, swing by. I'm on Insta at somaticgendering. I also want to give a shout out to several resources of influence for this conversation. Somatic Sex Education, you can find them at somaticsexeducator.com. The artist and one of my favorite teachers, Midori, planetmidori.com. Afrosexology, you can find at afrosexology.com. Pleasure Mechanics, they're at pleasuremechanics.com. And James Olivia Chu Holman, you can find them on Instagram at inquisitive_human.
Laurie a hâte de célébrer son anniversaire au resto. Elle y a pensé toute la semaine. Elle a invité ses amis. Elle a acheté une nouvelle robe. Elle s'est rendue au resto. Elle n'a pas pu rentrer dans le resto. Elle a dû ranger sa nouvelle robe. Elle n'a pas pu voir ses amis. Et elle y a pensé toute la semaine.
N'attendez pas de frapper un mur. Faites-vous vacciner. Le passeport vaccinal est maintenant exigé pour fréquenter certains lieux publics. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Le Prison Radio Show est une émission radio avec des nouvelles pour les prisonnières et leurs alliés et familles. L'émission cherche à confronter l'invisibilité des prisons et la lutte des prisonnières en se concentrant sur la racine de l'incarcération, de la police et de la criminalisation. Nous sommes dédiés à des programmes qui collaborent directement avec des personnes actuellement incarcérées. Dans cet esprit, nous aimerions vous faire savoir qu'on a une ligne téléphonique pour les prisonnières et leurs amis et familles. Vous pouvez nous appeler Collect de la prison de Bordeaux et de la prison Rivière-des-Prairies en composant le numéro 514-876-3748. Encore une fois, c'est 514-876-3748 pour les appels Collect. On a aussi un numéro normal qui est 438-337-8423. N'hésitez pas à appeler ce numéro et à nous laisser un message avec des nouvelles à partager sur l'émission ou un message audio pour vos proches à l'intérieur.
The CKUT Programming Committee is responsible for CKUT programming. If you have any specific complaint regarding anything you have heard on air at 90.3 FM in Montreal, please outline the nature of the complaint along with the precise program date and time. Letters must be signed with full name and current address of the individual or individuals lodging the complaint. Postal or personal deliveries only. CKUT's address is 3647 University Street in Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. The committee is committed to ensure listener complaints are given serious consideration. Listener feedback can be left at the following number: 514-448-4041, extension 2547.
Ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades of Amandla Radio, welcome back to this edition of our show for 1st of September 2021 here at CQUT 90.3. We're a bilingual news and an analysis of the continent of Africa. I'm Doug Miller, and tonight I have two things to share with you. It's been a long time since we've dealt with the question of Canadian aid and where does Canada stand on it. I have an interview with Owen Schalk, a writer and activist from Winnipeg, who wrote an excellent article in the most recent edition, August, of Canadian Dimension. Highly recommend it to you. Stay tuned and listen to that. And then out of The Guardian was a story very close to my heart of Lake Chilwa in Malawi drying up. And after I had read the article, I realized that the chief investigator who led the research and the action on rehabilitating the lake and the people who depended on it for a livelihood, he was a student of mine in Malawi when I was there in the 60s. And that led me to think about Lake Chad. So I have a follow-up story on Lake Chad. So stay tuned for Amandla.